The Tudor History and Travel Show is a podcast that brings Tudor history to life by exploring Tudor places and artifacts in the flesh. You will be travelling through time with Sarah Morris, the Tudor Travel Guide, uncovering the stories behind some of the most amazing Tudor locations and objects in the UK. Because when you visit a Tudor building, it is only time and not space which separates you from the past. And now over to your host, Sarah Morris.
Hello, my friends, and welcome to this month's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. Of course, it's Sarah here, your guide, the Tudor Travel Guide, welcoming you back. Now then, in a moment, I am going to be taking you on location to West Sussex to visit the ruins of what was once one of the grandest Tudor houses in England. It certainly has a fascinating story and was right at the heart of the Royal Tudor Court. But before then, I have a little bit of housekeeping, and it's good news because this month, September, marks the opening of my virtual autumn summit. Yes, this is a yearly summit and is a highlight of the Tudor Travel Guide year. This year, the summit, as I mentioned, I think, in the last podcast, is all about Anne Boleyn. It celebrates not only the 500 years since Anne's first recorded debut appearance at the English court as part of the Chateau Vert at what was then York Palace, but it also happened to coincide with the 10th anniversary of the publication of my novel about Anne Boleyn, Le Temps Viendra. So it seemed a bit of a no-brainer this year for me to dive deep into the world of Anne Boleyn. And in fact, the summit is called 500 Years of Anne Boleyn, It Girl, Icon and Legend. Okay, well, it's an exciting time for me because it's something that I work on all year, and I know that many of you out there will have tuned in to my previous summits about the Field of Cloth of Gold, about Cardinal Wolsey, and last year we focused on women of the Tudor age in power to peasantry, the art of being a woman in Tudor England. And this year, on the 16th, Friday the 16th of September, I will be opening booking to this year's summit, which will take place over the last weekend in October. That's the 29th and the 30th of October. I am thrilled to be announcing this year's summit, which I believe has the best lineup yet. Now, I will go into that lineup in more detail at the beginning of next month. But for now, simply mark the date in your diary, the 29th and the 30th of October, as the dates over which the virtual summit goes live. Pre-recorded sessions are aired on both the Saturday and the Sunday. However, I will stress that you do not need to be able to make the summit live. You may choose to tune in as each video is made live over the course of the weekend. But once you have bought your ticket, you will have the links to all the videos a week or so before the summit goes live. And once I make those videos live on YouTube, you can then tune in and watch them over and over and over again, right the way through until the end of the year. Yes, that is the 31st of December. So yes, I get a lot of questions on that. You do not need to be able to make that specific weekend in order to be able to enjoy this summit to the full. Okay, well, as I said, tickets will be opening mid-September. I'm hoping to launch them on the 16th of September. So you may keep an eye out for that. And if you want to be for sure notified about when those tickets go live, then the best thing that you can do is subscribe to my mailing list. And that is via the homepage of my website, which is www.thetudortravelguide.com. Okay, as I said, there'll be a little bit more coming, a little bit more detail coming about the summit in next month's podcast. But for now, I want to turn our attention to the task in hand. So, in fact, very recently, I headed down to West Sussex to see a house, which was, as I mentioned at the top of this programme, once one of the finest Tudor houses in England. It was commissioned and built by Sir William Fitzwilliam, later the first Earl of Southampton. Now, Sir William is an interesting character. He's somebody I looked at in some detail when I was writing Le Temps Viendre, a novel of Anne Boleyn, because he was one of the three men sent by Cromwell / Henry to interrogate Anne Boleyn after she had been arrested at Greenwich Palace. Now, if you have seen Holbein's sketch of Sir William, you will see a man with a cold and penetrating gaze, certainly not someone you would want to get on the wrong side of. As I say in my novel, this was a man hewn from the granite of Yorkshire, which was his home county. Early on in his life, William was placed as a child in the schoolroom alongside the young Prince Henry Tudor, just like, for example, Charles Brandon. Of course, he therefore grew up with the king, and once Henry VIII had been crowned, he started to amass positions at court and titles and honours. But he would only really reach the pinnacle of his career in 1537, when he was created the first Earl of Southampton, probably as a part or as a result of and a thanks for his willingness to be part of the destruction of Anne Boleyn and the Boleyn faction. As you will hear from our expert guide today, Paul Ullison, the new Earl of Southampton needed a fine country home as befitting his newly elevated status, and he chose Cowdray, next to the small town of Midhurst in West Sussex, in which to place his new country seat. Well, I think we've now set the scene. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, I give you Cowdray House and our expert guide, Paul Ullison.
Hello, Paul. Paul, welcome to the Tudor History and Travel Show.
Thank you very much. Nice to meet you again.
Well, yeah, it's lovely to be back, standing right in front of these glorious ruins. But before we start talking about Cowdray House, which, of course, is what we're here to explore today, and its wonderful history, maybe you could just introduce yourself and remind folk who you may be, because some people may not have seen that wonderful video that we did on my YouTube channel. And I would urge you guys who are tuning in that if you didn't see the video of Paul talking about the Tudor kitchens here at Cowdray, it is over on my YouTube channel. Just search the Tudor Travel Guide. But for those folk who didn't catch that, Paul, tell us about yourself.
So I've been working within the living history environment for nearly 30 years now and work predominantly in schools. Self-employed, have worked for a local museum for nearly 8-9 years, and then I also organise events, historical events locally, and then do a lot of talks and presentations to people. History to me is very much a living subject, and I think the more that we can promote that, the better, hence why working with Cowdray for 15 years has been brilliant.
And just to say, if people want to see you in your various guises, particularly made a rather handsome Anglo-Saxon, right there, Paul, and your Instagram account, they want to follow you on Instagram,
Stone
maybe?
Age, yes.
Oh, Stone Age.
Stone Age is the one on the Instagram, definitely. Okay. Yeah, so you can find me, literally tag my name and then you'll find me. And what I've done is I've over lockdown, I charted making everything from scratch. So everything was handmade. Huge bits of research for me. I'd never done things like fletching before. I'd never sewn leather before. Never made knives before, as in Stone Age knives. So yeah, that's all charted on the Instagram. So have a good look at that.
And it's at Paul. Can you spell?
So Paul and then Ullson, U-L-L-S-O-N.
Perfect. Thank you so much. So, well, you're not your ancient Briton in front of me today, but you are dressed rather handsomely as a Tudor gentleman, rather befitting of our time here at Cowdray today, because, of course, Cowdray was one of the most spectacular early Tudor houses of its day. So, Paul, before we get into exploring the wonderful history of this house, perhaps we could just flag up to those people listening how they might find out more about Cowdrey.
There is a website, and I would urge people to go to the website because that will have details about any events or potentially that you can book an event here at the ruins. Sadly, at the moment, as you can see, that it's not open on a daily basis to visitors. There's still quite a lot of conservation work that needs to be done. However, there are special events that we do throughout the years. There are walks and talks and presentations that we do throughout the years. All of that can be found on the website, and there should be an Instagram page up as well.
That's great. So, dear listeners, if you are enchanted by our discussion and want to come and see Cowdrey for yourself, do make sure that you check out the website for all the latest information. Right, now, let's dive in, Paul. So, you've already said we're standing right in front of the sort of the gatehouse range of Cowdrey House. An enormous, beautiful house in its day. Now it stands in ruins, and we're going to come into the later to talk about why this house is in ruins. But this wasn't the first house on the site, was it? Could you tell us about what was here before this home came into being?
Cowdrey means hazelwood. So there was a medieval hunting lodge here in Le Coudray, the hazelwood. And this was attached to a large manor house, fortified manor house, brackets castle, which is behind us on St Anne's Hill. Midhurst means middle wooded hill, and the Normans built a Mott and Bailey castle here in the centre of all the Anglo-Saxon villages, basically to control not only the market, the revenues, but also control politically and militarily should it arise. And it's next to the River Rother as well. So from there, they had a hunting lodge down here in the Hazelwood. Eventually, because of subsidence, the manor house brackets castle on St Anne's Hill then suffered quite badly, and they moved the building down here. So this one was a larger hunting lodge in stone and wood before the Tudors even came here. And from that foundation, probably the back range was then started. So that's the ground print of what we would know as the buck hall and the kitchen range. And then subsequent owners then extended out the courtyard. So now we've got this square courtyard, and we're standing in front of this, what looks like a castle, fortified gatehouse with oilettes, these gun loops, large big window, double gates. And you would literally dismount here in front of the gates and then be taken in, walking wise, into the courtyard. But this is about the second, maybe even the third phase of this building.
Wow, right. And I really wanted to talk about that owner of the house, the medieval hunting lodge, before Sir William Fitzwilliam got his hands on Cowdrey, because I think that's such an interesting story. Sir Davy Owen, tell us about him and tell us how Fitzwilliam came to get hold of Cowdrey.
So we have to go back quite a long way into the medieval period, and we're talking about a man called Owen Tudor, and he was a Welsh courtier who eventually then marries Catherine de Valois, the widow of Henry V, and has a brood of children with her. But he has an illegitimate eighth child, which is Davy Owen. So Davy Owen then, when Henry Tudor, Davy Owen's nephew, arrived at Milford Haven, this is 1485, this is pre-Battle of Bosworth, Davy Owen then is knighted and is also one of the standard bearers to Henry Tudor at the Battle of Bosworth. Now, being the illegitimate uncle of Henry VII, he then is rewarded after Henry became king with a marriage. And it just so happened that down here in Midhurst, we had Mary Boone, who was the last of her family. She was an heiress, had all this land, sitting around doing nothing. So the reward to Davy was that he marries this heiress, and then subsequently looks at the hunting lodge and says, that's not befitting of someone who is related to the king. Let's do some modifications. And here we are.
Oh, wow. And then, but this story that I came across of Fitzwilliam getting hold of Cowdrey through Davy Owen's son? And yeah, can you just explain that? Because it sounded like a bit of a backhand deal going on here somewhere.
It seems that either Davy or his son fell on hard times financially. And for whatever reason, the manor here was sold. The manor and the lands were sold. And William Fitzwilliam, now obviously being connected highly to Henry VIII, then benefited by buying all of this land and then he then subsequently said, well, this is not befitting, you know, the Earl of Southampton. I need, and the best friend to Henry VIII. I now need to do some more building work. So he then did what I regard as being phase two here. Right. And then eventually that passes over to his half-brother, Anthony Brown, who then goes on to do phase three.
Right. Now, when Fitzwilliam acquires this, what kind of date are we talking about?
We are talking about that Henry VIII period. So we are talking about that early to middle Tudor period, the sort of 1430s, that sort of area around there, maybe slightly bit earlier than that, I think. And again, because of his relationship with Henry VIII, we know Henry VIII visited here on more than one occasion. This would be seen to be, it's off the beaten track in the sense that it's not near a big city or a big port, or there's nowhere militarily, but it's on the way too. So you can go from Hampton Court, you can stop off here, you can go down to Portsmouth, Southampton. You can go up to London and vice versa, coming back to the south coast. So places like this, where your best buddies are staying, that you can just drop in and do some hunting locally and just chill out and relax, this would be ideal for Henry. He's away from all the prying eyes of all the other big political intrigues. And of course, this building benefited from his, dare I almost say, patronage. By coming here, it boosts up William's prestige as well.
Of course it does. And actually, thank you for mentioning the geography, because not everybody tuning in will know where Cowdray is. Can you just give us a bit of a geography lesson? Exactly how far away are we from London? How far away are we from the south coast? Just so people can visualise.
So if we were looking at a map of West Sussex, and if you imagine then at the bottom of your map is Chichester, and if you were looking at that map, if you then looked to the left, you've got Portsmouth, Southampton. If you were looking to the right of Chichester, you carry on, you've got Brighton. Carry on further, you'd end up at Hastings. That's all the south coast. But if you leave Chichester and you go directly north, you'll get to Midhurst. So Midhurst really is not quite a halfway between here and London, but you're looking about nearly a third of the way to London. So it's around about 66 miles from London to Chichester. We're looking around about 30 miles ish thereabouts. So it's a good staging point. And again, Henry VIII, we know, was at Hampton Court. And again, that's out of the London boroughs. Again, it's in that sort of area as well. So you're looking about maybe a day's ride, maybe 2 days' ride between some of these locations that he would go to.
Yeah, that's perfect.
But again, this is ideal for being quite central. It's northern Sussex, so we're not too far from Hampshire. We're not too far from Surrey. We're right in that part of the Downs where hunting is absolutely fantastic. The road system, obviously, by the Tudor times was more like glorified tracks. So you're not looking at super highways like the M1 or anything like that. But you're looking at areas that are well travelled, that there are good trade links by road and also by water as well. Because that's something that we don't often, you know, make a connection with. The Rother connects to the Arun. So if you can use the Arun as a staging point for transportation from the south coast to Arundel, from Arundel you can then link to other places as well. So there are all these networks of houses and courtiers and people that have got connections with the royal family, the Tudor royal family, are invaluable for the king and his entourage, because he's not just going by himself. It could be up to, you know, several hundred people with him. There is accommodation here for the king. And then obviously the owner of the house would then move out to somewhere else, just up the road, the former Benedictine Priory up there, which is also within the Fitzwilliam and Brown families. So, of course, you can have accommodation over there, accommodation here, and put other people up in the town as well.
Perfect. And I must say, for the modern day visitor, we've got the lovely little town of Midhurst, which is just adjacent
absolutely,
to Cowdray House,
yes,
which has some gorgeous little old buildings, doesn't it, in the old part of the town centre.
The nice thing about Midhurst is that standing building wise, you have got medieval, Tudor, Stuart, Georgian, Victorian, and then the modern housing estates. So although largely people pass through Midhurst, and they might think of Midhurst in connection with the polo that happens during the summer, then Midhurst is a lovely country town in the heart of Sussex, rural location all the way around it. But yes, it itself is a fantastic place. And then right next to it, you have got the fantastic ruins here as well.
Absolutely, so you do. So I'm turning to look at it again now. And can you just describe, as you've already talked about how this house was built in phases, what's the structure of the house? When it was finally completed, what were we looking at?
So when you're looking at the front of the building, what you're supposed to be thinking of, that this is a castle. So you've got these half hexagonal towers, in the centre of which is a very large double open gate, above which is now a window and the coat of arms of the Brown family. So this is all about giving you the idea that this is a castle rather than a house that you're approaching. It's basically saying, don't mess with me, we know how to deal with people that are being antagonistic. So you have to have a licence to crenellate. So that's why, again, it's got that fortification type feel. You've got these large gun loops here called oilettes.
And was it Henry VIII who gave the licence to crenellate, or did that come slightly earlier?
I believe it was Henry VIII, yes. I think he was the one who ordered this to be crenellated, although it may have been done slightly earlier. I'd be surprised if it was Henry VII. Mm. I always got the impression that it was Henry VIII. I mean, it's like the moving of the River Rother behind us. So there's a large causeway which leads down to the town of Midhurst, and you've got marshland either side of it. And then the River Rother, we know, was moved at some point. Well, the way I always describe it to visitors is, what do castles need as an additional fortification? It's a moat. So by moving that river, it's almost like you are now passing over the bridge, over the moat, coming up the causeway, sweeping up to this large castle-like building. You then dismount from your horse or come out your horse and carriage. You then led through the porch into the courtyard itself. So it is a squared building. Central courtyard is open, got this beautiful sandstone, which again, when it was first built, would have been almost gleaming white, like a shimmery white. It's now faded over time, so it's these patches of greys and yellows and browns, slightly moss covered. But you can imagine when it was first built, it would really stand out. And of course, anyone building out of stone, you are saying, we can afford it, we are the important people. But because it's now a ruin, it gives us an opportunity to look inside the walls, and there is all the brick. So all that brick that we can now see exposed on the left-hand side of the gatehouse, that would have all been covered up not only with sandstone, but also then being covered up with plaster on the inside or wooden panels. So the builders and the owners know that a huge amount of brick was being used in the construction, but we now have the insight, because it's now a ruin, to see how it was constructed. And that's a huge amount of building materials that have gone into this, and the big windows as well. You know, the more glass you've got, the bigger the windows you've got. It's all about showing off. It's all about prestige.
Do we have any idea how much it cost?
Yeah, from a cost point of view, I've never seen anything written down specifically regarding the cost, because I think that documentation might very well have been lost in the fire, the later fire, but also because this was one of several properties that the owners would have had. So the owner is not going to be based here every single day. They would visit here when they weren't visiting the king, and the king might be in several different locations around the country. Mm. And that was the idea, that you take your best friends, and also, you know, he was Lord Admiral as well, so he had specific responsibilities that might take him down to wherever the ships, the fleet would be based. So on that sort of basis, that documentation would have been held in different locations, and for whatever reason, as I said, I've never seen anything specific. I've seen speculations, but nothing specific.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you talked about guests arriving down the causeway and sweeping up to the gatehouse and dismounting and then going inside. I think that's what we should do. I know we can't go through the gatehouse because, as you pointed to earlier, there's a lot of crumbling masonry, isn't there? And you're doing a lot of renovation work, and so you can't get too close, but we can go around and get into the courtyard and pick up the visitor's journey, and maybe then we can talk about some of the features that we can see inside. Let's go.
Thank you.
Right, so we've come through the gatehouse and we find ourselves in the centre of the courtyard. Perhaps, Paul, you could just take a moment to try and reimagine for us what we're going to be seeing as the visitor comes through the gatehouse range.
So if we've come through the double gates of the gate tower, and now in front of us then will be an enclosed courtyard, and there will be a triangle of path in front of us. Right in the centre, at some point during the castle's history, there would have been a fountain here as well. So if we go down the right path, we're going to go to the porch, which takes us into the main building. If we went down the left path, that would take us down to a later phase of cellars, and there'll be a wine cellar over there, and that would be underneath what would have been the owner's apartments. And we know then that the owner, whatever respective visitor was coming here, would have given up his rooms, and that's where certainly Henry VIII would have stayed, certainly Elizabeth I stayed, in that area to the left.
So that's going to be in the northeast tower, which still, you know, the substantial ruins remain. So
hugely so.
We really get a good picture of that and the size of. Oh, wonderful. Are they octagonal? Is that an octagonal room in the tower?
You almost have, yes, it's almost an octagonal in its shape. And on the top, you can see the five Elizabethan chimney pots made out of brick as well. Mm. So you're looking again, the sandstone exterior, the brick on the inside, and then even if we're looking through the windows, you can still see that the wooden panelling would have actually covered up the brick. So the brick, yes, would have been almost like the infill, the middle layer.
Yeah.
And again, directly in front of us, we're looking at what would have been the Buck Hall. And so you've got this huge window, stone window, obviously the glass is now gone, which allegedly was the largest glassed window in the country. Now, Hampton Court will say that they had the largest one first. We would suggest that we would have had the largest one first. Either way, either we took inspiration from what Henry had at Hampton Court, or Henry took inspiration from what we had here, and he wanted one at Hampton Court.
Yes, I can imagine the latter.
Oh, the rivalry between the two men, I have no doubt. But what was curious is the porchway, which is the path to the right from the main gatehouse, has Henry VIII's coat of arms above the door. Now, he didn't own this building, but he has said, William, you're my bestest buddy, you can have the royal coat of arms above your porchway. Now, that's huge prestige, a massive prestige, because anyone coming here after that visit would know that the king himself had visited here. That's how important William was saying, I am that close to the king.
It's like royalty by appointment, as they have on various items of food these days.
Yeah.
But I must admit, you know, that East Range is, even in its ruinous state, is spectacular. Mm. The windows, you can only imagine the amount of light that must have poured into both the Buck Hall, the Great Hall, and the Privy Apartments. But maybe we just take a little walk down this path. You were suggesting the right-hand path. So we are now approaching as a visitor. There's a lovely porch that's appended to the lower end of the hall. And as you can say, above that door, there's a rather weathered coat of arms, and that's of Henry VIII. There aren't many of those surviving, are there, I seem to remember?
They're not, no. I can't give you an exact number, but I know there are not many royal coat of arms above porchways or above a building gateways that was not owned directly by the royal family.
Yeah.
So the very fact that, as I said, this has been granted, that William has been allowed to proclaim that the king has visited here and here are the royal coat of arms, a huge significance.
Yeah.
Inside the porch itself, if we were able to step in there, the whole of the ceiling would have been highly decorated, highly painted. There is William Fitzwilliam and his wife's coat of arms within the ceiling, the Tudor rose right in the centre. And again, we can only imagine the riot of colour just stepping into our porchway, which you're only theoretically going to pass straight through. Again, that would have been a real assault on the eyes, and that's what this is all about, is really the idea of saying we are wealthy enough to have all this luxury just in our porchway, and you haven't even got into the main apartments yet.
It's quite spectacular, isn't it, because that at least that survives, whereas many things have gone. We've got that carved stone interior of the porchway, which is utterly spectacular, and we can't go in and see it today, again, for the reasons we've already talked about. But I mentioned at the top of this recording that I do have a blog, just a reminder, folks, I do have a blog about Cowdrey, and there's lots of images, because we're lucky, aren't we, before the fire, which we shall talk about in a moment, people came and visited Cowdrey, and they recorded it visually. We've got some lovely images of the courtyard, and also people, you know, made notes, didn't they, in their diaries and letters about some of the contents. So we are lucky in some respects, if we're going to look on the bright side of the effects of this fire, that we do have some record of how this, what this place looked like in its glory.
And I think that's a really important point that you've just made there, where some of the other buildings that were destroyed in the Reformation, for example, religious buildings, we don't often have that documentary evidence, but we don't even have a visual evidence. Mm. We are lucky at Cowdray that there were paintings made of the building at its highest, at its highlight. And again, although there's only the East Range and the West Range still standing, it still is enough here to say this must have been an awesome building in its time. Add that into the illustrations as well, and you get, the visitor would get a really good impression of that this was a spectacular place to visit throughout most of its standing history. And even now, as a romantic ruin, it's still an incredible place.
It's still
place.
Glorious. As I say, we're going to come on to talk about its end at the moment because it's such a fascinating story. But I'd like to focus on a couple of the interiors. We can't go and see them, but again, just to sort of highlight maybe in a little bit more detail what they look like. And the first of those would be the Great Hall itself, which was kind of so famous, it even had a name, as you mentioned, Box Hall. Can you describe the glory of that space?
Well, certainly in the Brown time here, so this is the third family who were owning this building, then we know that there was a black and white marbled floor. There was no great fireplace, so we know that the hall itself, for entertainment, for dancing point of views, would have been heated either by the body heat or potentially charcoal braziers or things like that. So you've got a black and white marbled floor. You've got wood panelling on the walls itself. There were life-size statues of the deer that they were hunting within the park. There would have been tapestries hanging on the walls as well, paintings of the owners, the prior owners. There would have been the wooden ceiling itself, because unusually that the ceiling was an incredibly old part of the building and hadn't tended to be altered compared to some buildings. So you've got a very much a wooden interior, almost medieval feel about the building itself. There may have been a central smoke hole in the very, very top at one point, which suggests that maybe the earlier medieval hall may have had a central hearth, a central fire. But we don't know that, for example. We haven't got the archaeology to support that, so it's only a suggestion. But the whole of the Buck Hall itself would have been an area for entertainment. Temporary trestle tables would have been placed. People would have sat there. There would have been a dais at one end. There would have been certainly minstrels playing. There were a screen to separate where the servants were hustling and bustling down to where the kitchen would have been. And then behind the Buck Hall would have been the private apartments, the private area for private dining as well. And that's where the Cowdray engravings were, for example. So you've got zones within this building. It's not the huge hall, but nevertheless, the people who would be expected to dine there or be dancing there, to be entertained there, would be the nearest and dearest, not only to the owner, but also to the king. Mm. So the king might have arrived with 500 people plus, but not 500 people going to be being into that hall. That's going to be far more in an intimate gathering.
Right. Now, it's just occurring to me as you're speaking, what I'm going to do is I'm going to put a link to the video I was mentioning earlier of you giving us a guided tour of the kitchens, because the kitchens are intact here, so they're spectacular. And so it is worthy of having a look at that. I'll put a link, dear listeners, in the description below, so you can tune into that after you've finished listening to this podcast. Now, you mentioned the Cowdray murals. Now, in next month's podcast, we have a specialist on the Cowdray murals. Dominic Fontana is going to be talking to us right here from Cowdray about the most famous of those, which, of course, was the sinking of the Mary Rose. But just to whet our appetite, Paul, maybe you could just talk about that dining chamber and the murals. Where did they come from? Who commissioned them? And what could you have seen if you were a dinner guest?
I think you're sitting there at the table with William Fitzwilliam, Anthony Brown, whoever, and perhaps the king as well. And then around you would be this highly decorated scenes, the Siege of Boulogne, for example, Henry VIII's, one of his successes, or nearly success. And then you've also got, most importantly, the sinking of the Mary Rose. And it was because of, this is a drawing and illustration of what was there in situ, which never survived the fire, but because of that illustration, archaeologists were able to chart where the Mary Rose actually sunk, and that's when they actually found the ruins of the boat. So the building itself, that room itself, would it be far more as an intimate gathering, but again, high decoration on the walls itself. And again, if you have a look online and see what that illustration actually looked like, you can only imagine what the original highly decorated, highly painting, and that's just on the walls.
That's amazing. I think I read somewhere, if I'm right, and do correct me if I'm wrong, that they were from the late 1540s and that maybe the most likely commissioner was Anthony Brown, who actually appeared in all of those, because there was also the coronation procession of Edward VI.
Yes.
So it was like his highlights from his life.
Yeah.
And I know I've read somewhere Dominic saying something like, you know, this was a great way of Anthony being able to sit there with his dinner guests and go, I should just remember I did this and remember I did that.
Yeah. And again, by the time, this is after obviously the time that Elizabeth would have been visiting here as well. So the Brown family, it's a great bit of propaganda for them to have Elizabeth and showing all the deeds that the family had been involved with Henry VIII.
Yeah.
And it's promoting that their loyalty to the crown is still there.
Yeah.
This is a Roman Catholic family, don't forget. So, you know, Elizabeth being head of the Church of England, she was very, very tolerant to the Roman Catholics of her country as long as you acknowledged her as being the Queen.
Yeah.
As soon as you give your allegiance to the Pope, that's when things started to slide.
Yeah.
But Anthony Brown, he retained his Catholicism all the way through. So this is a great bit of propaganda. Our loyalty to the King, to the royal family, to your family, is still here, evident all the way around where you are now staying.
Perfect. Now, since you're talking about Elizabeth I, how many times did she come here? Was it just once? Was it more than once?
She certainly stayed here for a week. So I believe it's only once, but I'm open to be corrected on that one, but certainly once.
Okay. So, and beyond, on the upper level, on the first floor level, deeper into the private apartments, we were talking about it before, that northeast tower, this kind of octagonal tower. Now, am I right in saying there was a room called the Velvet Bedroom, which was the sort of the principal bedchamber? Is that where Elizabeth would have stayed?
Absolutely. The owner himself, you sometimes get up to 2 years' notice of a royal visit. And in that time, you'd be expected to refurbish everything, including providing a bed for the royal person to actually sleep in as well. So it's entirely possible that the owner at that particular time said, right, that's it, we've really got to get everything out. And so that was the height of luxury to say, this is a room prepared for you. And yes, this is where I would normally sleep, but you're actually having a specially commissioned bed, you know, specially made just for you.
Oh, that's wonderful, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I do remember reading that the windows, you know, lovely huge windows on those octagonal walls facing out into the park. What a splendid bedroom. I'd love to recreate that bedroom.
The views must have been spectacular, because from the east side, which is now the modern day rugby pitch, we think there probably would have been the formal gardens in that area. So there would have been knotwork gardens, highly scented and decorated flowers.
Yeah.
Again, you're still expecting people at this particular point in history, the paler your skin, the more wealthy you'll be regarded. So the ladies wouldn't go out in bright sunlight, but they would definitely go out on days like this, which is quite cloudy.
Yeah.
And there you are in your huge skirts and gowns, wafting your way through all the lavender and the rosemary and the other scented plants. And again, she has that view out of her window that she can see all the gardens. She can see the surrounding downlands and hills, trees as well, the forest that she would have been going out to hunt in as well.
Yeah.
And the same again when Henry VIII stayed here, that the forest that he would be going out hunting deer, because obviously the deer belong to the king and you have to have license to go and hunt the deer, that's all around him.
Yeah, wonderful. Now, I'm afraid we have to come to the end of the story of Cowdrey and why this house lies in ruins. And it's such a tragic tale. Perhaps you could tell us it, Paul.
It was 1793, so the family preparing for a wedding. And the family had actually moved out at that particular point to allow decoration to go on. And to my left, as we're standing in the courtyard now, to the north range, we think that the builders then had left some charcoal. The charcoal had fallen onto the floor. It was alight. That it was in the room where there was turpentine, so ready for thinning down paint. That caught fire. That the room, obviously, largely wood panel, very, very, very old, caught fire. The north range then seems to have gone very, very, very quickly. So you've got ground floor rooms. Then you'd have a large passageway corridor room full of paintings. You've got Corner Tower, you've got the tower we've just been describing where the private bedrooms are, all of that's now on fire. The wind was blowing from the north to the south, mm-hmm. so it was fanning the flames, the sparks. So as the wind was getting stronger and stronger at night, now the south range, which is now behind us, now catches fire. Obviously the roofs of both the other wings, so the east wing and the west wing, are now on fire as well. This has now alerted the townsfolk. The townsfolk are coming up using the River Rother with buckets to try and throw water on it. But it's tinder dry on the inside. Yeah. And once the building had caught light, you could be seen from miles and miles away. And also then it was burning for days afterwards. They had no insurance. They could never afford to rebuild it. And so after the family had to vacate the ruinous buildings, they were still using it for apartments for some of the staff who were staying. So the kitchen tower, for example, had an additional floor placed inside, and they were using that for rooms as a record room, I think, for at one point as well. But then it was just a slow demise for nearly 150 years, nearly 200 years, as the ruin just crumbled down and people came to rob the stone. So if you're looking around at the houses in Midhurst, many of the stone that was originally here facing the building would have been used in the houses that are now still standing in Midhurst.
One of the most, I think, the saddest, most tragic parts of this story is for me is my understanding is, going back to the point you were making about the fact that they were renovating the house and that they'd moved a lot of the artworks from all over the house into the North Gallery. And that's why so much was lost. I mean, I think I remember reading, I can't remember how many paintings there were, but I think like only three survived or something.
I think so. It was a travesty on so many levels, and there were certainly artefacts here that dated back to the time of William the Conqueror.
Yes. Can you speak a little bit about those? Because it makes me cry.
Yeah, I think you've got lots of things that were hanging over from the de Boon family, Davy Owen's only connections here as well, William's family connections, and then the Browns family. So you've got all these family connections that all piled up their respective artefacts into this building over time. It was one of the grandest ones that the de Boon family owned, even as a hunting lodge. But certainly when they married into Davy Owen's family, then obviously this became a bit more prestige building. So a lot of the smaller manor houses that the de Boons owned, they sold off bit by bit. So as you said, all these paintings were in one location, all these artefacts were in one location, and they couldn't find the keys to the pump house, so they had no way of getting additional water to stop the fire. That even with several hundred people from the townsfolk, that still was never going to be enough to form the bucket chains to put out a fire that was already now ranging in two of the major wings of the building. So it was only a matter of time before the whole thing started collapsing, which it duly did. But yes, the loss of artefacts, what has actually survived from the fire, is minimalistic. It's comparable to what happened at Windsor. But when you think about what happened at Windsor with all of our technology, we managed to save so much of that building, and the restoration work was absolutely phenomenal. But there were still people running in and grabbing things and running out.
Yeah.
Now, you can imagine people trying to do that here.
Yeah.
But if the North Range is the first range that's gone
and
up,
it's got all the things in it.
There was nothing else that they could grab anywhere else as such.
It makes me so sad, because I did a bit of research for the blog, and again, folks, if you want to read a little bit more about some of the paintings and the like, but it was like the coronation robe of William the Conqueror, and I was like, oh, it's just mind-blowing.
And you think, even if it wasn't the original one, then it certainly would have been from the medieval period. So again, high prestige, and we know that a lot of the great houses and churches and castles always wanted to try and have something of antiquity to draw visitors into their particular area. So if they had the coronation robes of William the Conqueror, I mean, what a loss.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think also my reading, it seemed to be some debate about whether there were Holbeins here. I mean, I can't believe that there weren't Holbeins here. I think, did he stay here for about a month or so? Or is it about myth and legend? What do you know about that, Paul?
I think that there is a myth and legend about Holbein staying here. I could well imagine that he did stay here. And I could well imagine that there would have been Holbeins here.
Yeah.
William Fitzwilliam was certainly wealthy enough to commission such things. Henry VIII stayed here, and Holbein was one of his best painters.
Yeah.
And certainly there are other Holbeins in some of the other local houses in this area. So why wouldn't there be
here? There must have been.
I would find it impossible to believe that there weren't, to
be honest. Yeah, me too. Yeah. And that is another sort of mix. It's another tragedy, I have to say. Well, the pragmatists upon us might just think that this was just a bit of careless workmanship that set the fire going. But there's another story to tell, and I love this story because it is full of myth and legend, and that, of course, is the Curse of Cowdrey. Paul, enlighten us.
Well, during the dissolution of the monasteries, both William Fitzwilliam and his brother, Anthony Browne, his half-brother, Anthony Browne, were responsible for the dissolving of monastic communities. So William is here at Esbourne, next to Midhurst, and dissolving the Benedictine nuns who are over here. And Sir Anthony Browne was over in Battle, dissolving the Benedictine community over there. So the two branches of this particular curse, depending if you believe in such things. Number one is either the priest who is based here at Esbourne or the senior nun laid a curse on William Fitzwilliam's family that they shall perish by fire and water. Meanwhile, over at Battle Abbey, the last monk being booted out over there put a curse on Anthony Browne's family that they shall be perishing by fire and water. Here we go then for 200 plus years later, that this building then burns down. And subsequently, members of the family, one died shooting the rapids on the River Rhine.
Yes, and it was like literally, wasn't it like the day after the house went up in flames? I mean, literally within days.
Absolutely. So the fire and water bit was very, very, very close together, and it was a direct descendant from Anthony Browne as well. William Fitzwilliam obviously had no children, so his line finished with him, so that's why it passed over to his half-brother, Anthony Browne. And then subsequently, more members of the family died in a boating accident off of Bognor, and then that finished off the male line at that particular point. So if it was a curse, it took nearly 250 years to take effect, but nevertheless, Sir Anthony Browne's line, William Fitzwilliam's family line, the building burnt down with fire, the family perished by water.
Well, maybe all the best curses just take a little while to come to fruition.
Possibly. Possibly.
I can see you're a little sceptical on this one, Paul.
Do you know, I'm a great believer because of the various different things that people have reported over the years, that I think that stone does hold memory of people that have been here in the past, whether people perceive that as a ghost or whether they perceive it like a repeating incident of people that have been here or things that may have happened, which is why, you know, Anne Boleyn's ghost can be seen in so many different places. It's not the same ghost, but it might be the memories of her. This building definitely holds memories, 100%. It is very, very atmospheric, and I think that whether people believe in curses or not, I think that this building itself, the history of this building, the history of the families, it's incredible just to see what has survived, but what would have been here and has been lost. But the stories are so incredible, absolutely incredible. So whether you believe in the curse or not, coincidence or otherwise, the building burns down, the family die with water.
There you have it, the end of Cowdrey, as it was known at the time. But of course, it lives on. It's still here. It's still, as we've been saying, and I'm sure you've got a feel for this, dear listeners, a still a magnificent ruin, which you can visit. Now, can we just go back and clarify? It's not open regularly because of the fact that you're working on the restoration and conservation. You can see it from the outside, but you can't actually get into the ruin at the moment, except on certain events or certain tours.
Absolutely, and that's why it's always best to check out the website to see what is going on throughout the year. We have specialist tours, we have talks and presentations, and sometimes we even have events going on as well. But no, you're correct, we can't actually get inside the ruins at the moment. A huge amount of conservation work we're still funding for to be able to do to get that open to visitor access that we were in the past. But it's something that we really want visitors to be aware of, that even though you can't get into the ruins themselves, there are still things going on, that you can still go around the outside. We can still access the finest preserved Tudor kitchen in the country, and we can still go in there and use that as a working kitchen as well. So it's definitely worth your visitors coming here, but after they have checked out the website first. You can walk around it, as you say, and lots of people do, but to come here when there's an event on, when there's something specific going on, I think that's when you get the best out of your visit.
Check out the website, right. And of course, as ever, I will be putting a link to that website in the description associated with this podcast. Well, I think that leads us to the end of our story. I just have to say thank you very much for helping us explore Cowdery House today, Paul.
Thank you very much, and hopefully we'll see you again down here very soon.
I hope so. I can't wait to get inside. That's what I'm looking forward to. So I hope I get an invite, Paul.
You make will. Sure it's I assure you, you will. You most definitely will.
Thanks very much.
Well, my friends, I sincerely hope you enjoyed that exploration of the fascinating history of Cowdery House. It is a beguiling ruin, and as you heard, while you can't access it in full at the moment, it is worth visiting and keeping an eye out for special events that are going on. And as I mentioned in that recording, I will place links to the Cowdery website in the description associated with this podcast. I'll also put links to my blog about Cowdery House, where you can read a little bit more detail. And in particular, you can see pictures of many of the things that are talked about between Paul and I when we recorded this on location. And if you are interested in hearing more about those Cowdery murals, as I mentioned in the recording, in next month's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show, I am back at Cowdery to talk about all the murals, but in particular the one of the Mary Rose with Dominic Fontana, who has researched the murals extensively. It is a truly eye-opening conversation. I learned so much from Dominic. But in the meantime, I just wanted to thank the staff at Cowdery Estate, in particular Sally Guile, and of course our guide today, Paul, for welcoming us and making this podcast possible. Thank you so much. Your hospitality was so greatly appreciated. And finally, just before I go, a quick reminder to say, if you are interested in booking your place on this year's virtual summit, 500 Years of Anne Boleyn, It Girl, Icon, Legend, then make sure that you hop on over to my blog, www.thetudortravelguide, and subscribe to my mailing list. I will be sending out a notification as soon as the doors open. Okay, as I said, more coming on that next month. But in the meantime, I just want to thank you so much for joining me for this Tudor adventure in time down in West Sussex. I do urge you to put the county on your itinerary. It has a lot to offer and is oft overlooked. Okay, well, wherever you are in the world, have a lovely few weeks, and I will be back here next month with another episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. Bye for now. Thank you for tuning in to this month's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. If you've enjoyed the show, please subscribe, like, and rate this podcast so we can spread the Tudor love. Until next time, my friends, it's happy time travelling!